Morning, everybody. I'm not Susan Nelson. In case you check the website or the front porch, Susan's listed as giving the talk today. But she's been ill this week, so I'm giving the talk today, and she'll be giving the talk next week. So I'm Rosemary. Our Doan is out of town this week, and the person who was supposed to be Doan is sick this morning. So Ted is the substitute Doan. This is one of the things that we do for each other. That's how I got to be actually Doan twice this last week, Monday and Tuesday nights. Monday is my usual night. The Doan's the person who comes and opens the place up and lights the candles and hits the bells, leads the meditations, and I usually do it every other Monday night. But this week, the person who was doing Tuesday nights was gone this week, so I subbed for him. And both nights I sat alone here in the general. Poor me. I sat all by myself, and that almost never happens. Monday night I told myself, well, it's really cold out. It's really, really cold out. And Tuesday, it wasn't so cold out. So I told myself, it's a holiday week. But I was really torn, you know, because part of me really likes sitting here alone. Part of me really likes being here in this room, you know, all alone. Especially in the winter because it's dark, you know, and it's really quiet because of the snow and the windows are closed. And so part of me really likes it. And also I get to feel very virtuous. and I always like that, especially the second night, because after the first night I got home and I told my husband that I sat all by myself. And then the second night he said, nobody's going to be there. You're going again? And I said, why? Yes, I am. So I got to feel very virtuous. And then after a while, I started to get kind of a kick out of watching myself be virtuous, you know. And then I said, you know, but because of my many years of Zazen, I'm noticing that I'm watching myself be virtuous. You know, and so that just kind of spun on and on and on for a while on Tuesday night. But at some point, I sort of dropped that game and picked up another one. I thought, really, I'm not alone in the Zendo. I'm sitting here with everyone who's ever sat in the Zendo. And that felt pretty wonderful. You know, I started thinking about all the people who have sat in this Zendo, you know, throughout the years. And so I had this mental thing going for a while if I was sitting with all of them. And then I invited in everybody that I had ever sat with, you know, and it was like the Vimalakirti Sutra, you know, where he's in this little room and it's just full of deities and, you know, whatnot. So that was pretty interesting. But then at some point I had to drop that too. But you know, there's something about the idea of all those people having sat here for all those years. You know, you can almost sort of feel it in the walls. You can almost feel it. There are places that are like that. I know, you know, it's not just this place. I know of other places that have that kind of, I don't want to use the word vibe, but they've got that going. excuse me. Years ago, in 1976, I took a road trip across the country. I went all the way from New York to San Francisco and then went up and came back through Canada and camped out all along the way and stayed at a lot of gorgeous places. But one of the places that I really remembered afterwards, wasn't that beautiful? And I didn't really know anything about it. But it was this place in South Dakota, and I camped there. And afterwards, for years, I thought, there was something about that place. You know, and I couldn't really put my finger on it, but there was just something about it. You know, it felt kind of like holy ground to me. And it wasn't, you know, for years later that I found out that it was. It was a Native American holy spot. It was Bear Butte in the Black Hills, which, you know, the Black Hills are holy ground for some of the American Indians, and Bear Butte in particular is sort of a very holiest of the holy grounds. So, you know, I found that out years later, and about 20 years after I originally camped there, I went back, and I was really excited. I thought, you know, now, you know, I know what I'm going to. This is really going to be great. And, you know, I got there, and I expected something. Nothing. You know, I didn't feel anything, and I really expected to have some kind of wonderful experience. But I think that, you know, I had built this thing up in my head, and I kind of put a box around it. And then, of course, when you go back and you're looking for that box, it's not there. So the second time I was there, I just had to experience Bear Butte as it really was at that time, you know. And that's the way that it was in the Zendo after I dropped about my third game of, you know, entertaining myself, was just sitting here in the Zendo without anybody else to, you know if I was here doing the bells or to care, you know, or to know if I rang them a little early to get out early, which I did not. You know, I just had to sit in the Zendo as it was that night. And so that's what I want to talk about tonight, this morning, since I'm here all alone in the Zendo. I want to talk about as it isness. I really like that term, as it isness. And I want to structure it around a koan that I was reading this week. And I really like this koan because you can go kind of all different ways with it. It's got a number of different kind of twists and turns. So the koan was a new one to me. I don't know where it comes from. I read it in a little book. So here it is. Zen master Nangaku Dai visited the sixth ancestor. The ancestor asked, "Where did you come from?" Nangaku replied, "I came from Mount Suzan, where the national teacher Aeon lives." The ancestor asked, "What is it that comes like this?" And Nangaku never forgot the question. After he had practiced with the ancestor for 8 years, he finally understood the question. And then he said to the ancestor, "When I first visited you, you asked me what it is that has come like this. Now I understand." And the ancestor said, "How do you understand it?" And Nangaku said, "If I try to point out one thing, I go astray." The ancestor asked, "Then is there practice and enlightenment or not?" Nangaku said, "It is incorrect to say there is no practice and enlightenment, but we should not defile them." The ancestor said, "Non-defilement, that is the thing the Buddhas and ancestors have maintained. You are like this. I am also like this. And the ancestors in India were also like this." So that's the whole thing. So Zen master Nangaku Dai visited the sixth ancestor. And the ancestor asked, "Where did you come from?" And this being a koan, that's not, of course, really what he's asking. What he's really asking is, who are you? Who are you really? You know, what's your original face? He's asking, what constellation of causes and conditions brought this person here before me at this particular moment in time? And when Nangaku replied, "I came from Mount Suzan, where the national teacher Aeon lives," you know, it's a natural answer, you know, but it's not the answer to the question that he was being asked. But, you know, it's a natural answer. You know, somebody asks you, "Where did you come from?" You know, and I'll say, I come from Minneapolis, you know. Or somebody might say, I drove in from Eau Claire this morning. You know, it's a natural answer, but Nangaku didn't know he was in a koan, so he. But his answer actually, given this framework, it's sort of beside the point. It doesn't really tell us anything. And when you think about it, that, you know, giving that answer, doesn't tell you anything about who I am at all. So then the ancestor asked, what is it that comes like this? And at this point, Nangaku knows there's something else going on. And his brain just stops. It just completely stops and he doesn't know what to do. But he never forgot the question. And he must have been really impressed by the sixth ancestor because he hung around for 8 years and he practiced with them. And he carried the question around. It became sort of his personal koan. And I don't know if you've ever had a question like this that's really stuck with you, but when it happens, sometimes you don't even get to choose it. You know, somebody says something like that and your brain just stops and then it stays with you. And so I think that Nangaku spent the next 8 years with this question just kind of there. I think of it as being right about here, over over your shoulder and behind your head, and it just kind of stays with you. Like, you know, and it's always sort of there in the background somewhere, just kind of asking, you know, what is it that comes like this? So it became his koan, but it wasn't sort of an annoying little voice back there. It's sort of a valued companion. You know, it just kind of stays there with you the whole time. And it's always sort of at the edge of your consciousness. It's like having something at the tip of your tongue. It's sort of always there. So he sat with that question for 8 years. And at the end of the 8 years, he goes back to the ancestor and he says, when I first visited you, you asked me what it is that has come like this. Now I understand. And he goes back to the ancestor, and I imagine that he's pretty confident, because when you carry something around like that, at some point, at a really kind of unexpected time, it just cracks open for you, and you get it, and you know you've got it. It just becomes so completely obvious that, you know, you sort of can't wait to go to the teacher and say, well, you know, I get it. Here's what I figured out. So he goes to the ancestor, and the ancestor says, how do you understand it? And so the ancestor's been really patient with him all this time, you know. I imagine that the sixth ancestor knows that he's been working on this as a koan. You know, he might have come into the sixth ancestor in Doksan, in private meetings, you know, through that 8 years and said, you know, I'm struggling with this, I'm trying to understand it, kind of, I can tell it doesn't mean this, but, you know, give me some help here. And the ancestor does what any good Zen teacher will do at a time like that. And he won't, or she won't, give you the answer, but what she'll do is sort of pick you up and turn you around and say, well, what do you think? Or, you know, let's look at it from this angle, or look at it from this angle, or look at it from over here. And they'll try to sort of give you pointers to direct you in one way or another. Tim actually did that with me the first time I was here in Doksan. It's the reason that I'm still here. I went into Doksan with him, and we were talking, and all of a sudden he asked me something, and I don't remember what happened, but anyway, he just kind of, with some question that he asked, he just kind of picked me up and turned me. Not literally, but you know. And I was so impressed by that. That I said, you know, I have to stick with this guy. So I imagine that's what the sixth ancestor has been doing with him over this 8 years. He's been kind of helping him figure out how he's going to figure out the answer to this question. Of course, you don't figure it out. It just answers itself at some point. So the ancestor says, how do you understand it? And I don't think that's a kind of a challenging question. I think it's a very sort of dispassionate question. He's just asking, so, tell me. So, Nangaku says, if I try to point out one thing, I go astray. If I try to point out one thing, I go astray. So he's saying, if I try to explain myself as this or as that, that's not it. You know, I can't tell you one thing or another thing about myself and have that be a complete person who's standing in front of you. Years ago, I worked at Burlington Northern Railroad. I was a contract tech writer, and I wrote computer manuals. And when I came in, there was a woman who had worked there who had left shortly before I was there, named Janet. And every so often, I would hear about Janet, and I would see manuals she had written and stuff. And after I'd been there for about a year, I heard that she was coming back. And so I asked one of the other tech writers, you know, well, what's Janet like? And this woman said, she's quiet and she likes books. And I thought, okay, I know who Janet is, you know. And then, of course, she got there. And I mean, you know, she's quiet. You know, she was quiet and she did like books. But that didn't give me any idea at all of who Janet was. So that's kind of the flavor of what he's saying here. If I point to one thing or another thing, or if I try to describe, you know, I could sit here all day and describe this or that or the other thing about myself, but whenever I try to point to who I am by any of those means, I completely miss it, and so will you. Because you can't express your true self in words. That's why, you know, there's another koan that says, the master says, show me your original face. And, you know, he doesn't say, tell me about your original face. You know, he has to say, show me. And you have to actually show it. You can't describe it. Or it's like the story of Bodhidharma, you know, the first ancestor who came from India to China, and he's in front of the emperor. And the emperor says, who are you? And he says, I don't know. And I think that Bodhidharma, you know, knew who he was, but knew that if he tried to say who he was, it was a trap he was going to fall into. And even if he could say who he was, the person that he said he was wouldn't be the person the emperor saw sitting in front of him. So he said, I don't know, and then he went and sat in a cave for 9 years. You know, it's one of those questions that you just can't answer with words. It's too big of a question. All you can do is be that person. All you can do is be them. On Tuesdays and Saturdays here during the service, we do the Formless Repentance chant, and it starts out with all my ancient twisted karma. And, you know, that's who we are. We are a conglomeration or a constellation of all that ancient twisted karma, all the causes and conditions in our lives that sort of came together at this moment to present this here this morning. So all we can do is present that. We can just present that. A number of years ago, I went out to Spirit Rock meditation center in California and studied for a week with Stephen and Martine Batchelor. And Martine is a meditation teacher who spent 10 years in a Korean Zen nunnery. And the head of the nunnery gave them one question and one question only to practice with. All of them. Everybody had the same one. And it was, what is it? What is it? And that was their question. So everywhere they went and everything they did and everything that came in front of them, they were supposed to ask, what is it? You know, what is it really? What is this? What is this? And she said it's turned into kind of a lifelong koan for her. And it becomes sort of the ground of mindfulness, I think. Just asking yourself with everything that appears in front of you, what is this? What is it? It's sort of it's a lifelong koan. It's sort of the basic koan of our lives. What is this that's happening right now, right in front of me? And I think that the head of the monastery intended for them to wanted the question to help them approach everything that popped up in front of them, every person, everything, every experience, with sort of a lively curiosity, kind of a lively curiosity and interest. It's like approaching everything that comes up in front of you with beginner's mind, with beginner's mind. So that's the idea behind this. If I try to point out one thing, I go astray. You know, there's not one thing you can point out. So then the ancestor asked, then is there practice and enlightenment or not? And it sounds like a non sequitur. And maybe it is a little bit, but the I think what the ancestor is doing is just kind of redirecting the conversation a little bit. He's asking, so you've given me this answer. Do you need to practice in order to have this realization, in order to be able to come up with this answer? You know, is this the fruit of 8 years of practice? He's asking, you know, did you spend 8 years with this question and come up empty, and that's your answer, you know? Or did you practice with it and this is the answer that you came up with, you know? Or is it something different, or what? You know, he's asking kind of, or what? And, you know, it's a really interesting question, in particular for the sixth ancestor, because if you know the story of the sixth ancestor, it's the sixth ancestor means the sixth carrier of the lineage in China, and it's Wei Ning. And Wei Ning's story is that he came to the monastery and he was hadn't been there very long, and he's working as a he's working in the kitchen, and there's a senior student at the monastery, the senior student at the monastery. His name is Shen Sui. And Shen Sui has been there since he was, you know, a young teenager or something. And he's kind of done the practice. You know, he's been there, he's put in his time on the cushion, and he sat, and he's taken a lot of instruction, and he's kind of worked his way up through the hierarchy. And now he's the senior student, and he's the one who actually teaches the other students. So he's had this kind of, well, the story likes to present him as kind of this plodding kind of practice, you know. He's gone along and gone along and gone along and gone along. But I think of him as somebody who's just kind of been on this path in a real steady way, and he's just been on the path. So Wei Ning comes along. He's this illiterate kitchen worker, and there's a contest. It's sort of a poetry contest, but it's really to see who in the monastery has the best understanding and who's going to become the next abbot. And Wei Neng actually wins the contest over Shen Sui, who's been kind of plodding along and plodding along. So when the sixth ancestor, when Wei Neng asks, is there practice and enlightenment or not, he's kind of asking, is this something that you go along the path and do the practice and then boom, there's enlightenment? Or does enlightenment just kind of happen? It just kind of happens. So it's an interesting question for the sixth ancestor to ask. And Nangaku answers by saying, it's incorrect to say that there is no practice in enlightenment, but we should not defile them. But we should not defile them. So he's saying, we can't deny that there's practice and enlightenment. We can't deny that there's this sort of path. And then the second part of it is, but we should not defile them. Well, how can you defile practice and enlightenment? Now, how can you defile them? I think the way that you can defile them is by discriminating between the two of them, by saying this over here is practice and this over here is enlightenment. It's like saying nirvana and samsara are two different things. You know, this daily life that we have of our sorrows and troubles and plans and activities is one thing, and then nirvana, the absolute, is this other thing over here. And if you say that they're two different things, that's how you defile them. But on the other hand, you can't say, you know, you can't deny that there's some, you know, samsara over here and nirvana over there. So that's his answer. And I think in a way he's saying, you know, that we need to kind of let go of that mind that's always picking and choosing. We have to let go of that mind that's always saying, you know, I want this, I don't want that. I want nirvana, I don't want samsara. I want enlightenment, I don't want to have to, you know, sit for 20 years to get it. But on the other hand, you know, we can't pretend to be some plaster saint who doesn't discriminate in the world. I mean, we can't pretend to be the Doan who sits here on Monday and Tuesday night all by themselves. And it doesn't matter to me in the least whether I'm here all by myself or not. You know? I mean, on the one hand, it doesn't. But, you know, if I tried to tell you that it doesn't, you'd go, give me a break. Of course it does. Of course it does. So, you know, we need to somehow let go of that mind that's always picking and choosing. And one of my favorite ways to let go of that mind is by making fun of it. You know, look at what you're doing here. Look what you're doing again. So the ancestor says, non-defilement, that is the thing the Buddhas and ancestors have maintained. Some of the translations say, another translation says, that is the thing that the Buddhas and ancestors have protected. So they've maintained it or they've protected it. You are like this, I am also like this, and the ancestors in India were also like this. So non-defilement, that is the thing the Buddhas and ancestors have maintained or protected. So when we defile things, we're altering them with our ideas, you know. We're taking bare butte and saying, I have this idea of what this holy place is, and I'm putting it in this box, and this is what it is. Well, that's really defiling the whole idea of what's there at Bear Butte, I think. And the ancestors and the Buddhas have been maintaining and protecting the Buddha Dharma all these years. That's what they've been protecting. They've been protecting the teachings the Buddha handed down. They've been passing it down untainted throughout the years. On Saturdays, we have a service where we chant the names of all the ancestors, of all the Buddhas and the ancestors, the seven Buddhas before leading up to Shakyamuni Buddha. And then, you know, Buddha taught the Dharma to Mahakashapa, who taught it to Ananda, who taught it to this one, all the way down through India and China and Japan. And so those are the Buddhas and ancestors in our particular lineage. And when we chant them on Saturdays, I just find it really moving. I imagine this sort of bucket brigade of these people throughout the centuries, you know, passing along this bucket, you know, of the Dharma without spilling any of the water. And you know, passing it down to us. And you know, maybe as each one taught it to the next person, or as it went through India to China to Japan, or to the U.S., certainly, it picks up different cultural connotations, and the teachings are taught maybe in kind of a different way. But really, it's been passed down, I think, remarkably untainted. And the reason I can say that is because if we go back and look at the original Pali, you know, the first written transcripts of what Buddha said, that were written, 100 years after he died? A couple hundred years after he died? But if we look at those, it's recognizable to us. You know, it's presented in a really different way, you know, in Zen than it is in one of the other traditions. But it's absolutely recognizable. So I think it has been really passed down untainted. So the ancestor says, non-defilement, that's the thing the Buddhas and ancestors have maintained and protected. You are like this, I am also like this, and the ancestors in India were also like this. So each one of those ancestors, as we chant them, there's something like 90 of them, 88 names or something. Each one of those people, each one of them was like this, like this, like this. You know? Each one of them was somebody who you can't describe. Each one of them was just this person in front of you. Each one of them had that kind of, they all have Buddha nature. They all have that capacity for enlightenment that's common to everybody, but they also have this particularity about them, this as-it-is-ness. So I was going to talk about the fact that my name is Buddha nature, especially since Marty's sitting here and his name is Buddha nature too, but that's a whole another talk. Let's not get into that. I really want... Oh man, you know, when I went through Zen initiation through the ceremony, you know, the with my first teacher, you know, everybody goes up and they get this Dharma name, and people are getting these great names like Manifesting Peace and Universal Heart. I went back and looked up. One of them was Original Dragon. Another one was Treasure Store. You know, they're these great names, and I'm thinking, oh boy, this is it, you know. And I go up, and my name is Buddha Nature, and I went, that is such a generic name. Like, doesn't everybody have Buddha Nature? I wanted to be, you know, Treasure Store or Original. I wanted something that described who I was, you know, in some way. And Buddha Nature, what the heck? And so I sat with it like a koan, and now I really like it, because what it is, you know, to me, what it is this as-it-is-ness. It's this as-it-is-ness, as you are, right now, right here, not going to put you in a box, not going to say you're Dragon Mountain or whatever, but that you're just simply Buddha nature. So anyway, but there is a whole talk about that, Marty. We'll do it sometime. Just not today. Just not today. So So, let me see here. So my idea that it's somehow better to be sitting with other people, that I prefer that to sitting with just myself, or that it's great sitting here at night all alone in the zendo, it's all mine, you know, I can be virtuous, blah, 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 blah. You know, either one of those ideas is sort of defiling my zazen, or not defiling my zazen maybe, but defiling my intention to just sit there, to just be there with that as it isness, as it really is, on this, you know, really cold winter night at the beginning of the holiday season. So that's what I wanted to say about as it isness this morning, I think. Anybody else want to say anything about as it isness this morning? Or defilement this morning? My husband asked me what I was talking about today, and I said, I'm talking about defilement and as it isness. And he just, you know, he said, yeah, good luck with that. This is why he doesn't practice, because I tell him things like that. I'm going to talk about defilement and as it isness this morning. So was that all perfectly clear? Or yeah.
Well, I'm always looking for connections between writing and Buddhism and writing as a form of practice. And so I was just finding one today as we were talking about the impossibility of pointing to something that is solid. And this is something that actually when teaching I teach literary nonfiction, autobiographical writing. And my students are always trying to kind of portray themselves on the page and always feeling like they can't quite do it. And kind of increasingly becoming aware of the fact that they can't quite do it. And the lessoning is quite good, and you know, it's not really me, it's sort of part of it. And I'm always telling them, you can't, there's no way if you have a million pages. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's just really the same thing, that it's really the same thing that we're just saying, that there's no way to say who we are.
That's right. Yeah, there isn't. And particularly for writers, poor writers really just have this dilemma, you know. And all they can do is have this body of work.
That's
you know.
Right.
And even then, you know, we have this huge body of work, you know, of Hemingway's. And then we say, so we know who Hemingway was, you know. And, you know, we have no idea who Hemingway was. Or we have some idea, but it's an idea.
It's an idea, and all we can do is kind of come at it obliquely.
Exactly.
In some way, and
yeah.
It's a little glimpse, but that's all.
Yeah, yeah, and it's all right.
And it's all right.
And it's all right, yeah. Yeah, it's true.
The difference between a story and a description, that while still you want to reveal something or say something about yourself or see something about yourself or someone else, you tell a story, which is basically how you start out. That there's something about telling a story that takes us outside ourselves, and it's much different than trying to make a description. And I love stories. And to me, if I wanted to tell somebody something about myself, I would try to think of, okay, what's a story that I know about myself?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, stories are big traps too, but that occurs to me when I listen to you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Telling those stories, kind of getting at it, kind of sideways like that. Way better than saying, you're quiet and you like books. She is quiet and she does like books. Scott, you had something.
Yeah, back to Hemingway.
Yeah.
Very on Hemingway experienced terror when looking at an empty sheet of paper. That's an appropriate response.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a thing. I mean, and I've experienced that too. You know, in my career as a writer, and geez, I was writing computer manuals for crying out loud. But there is that terror of facing that blank page and going, "How do I begin to explain this?" You know, it's a joke with writers, but it is so true. You know, the first probably 2/3 of any writing project is avoiding writing. And it's true for no matter what kind of writing you do, I think. Was that true for you? That was certainly true for me.
I think it's true to some extent.
Yeah, and it's that terror because you know that you can't possibly really put something on paper that's going to be really true. Yeah, or to do your best.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is why Anne Lamott says that you should always start off with a really terrible first draft. Just get something down. That's not the word she uses, but the mic is on, so. You should always start with a really terrible first draft. Just make some kind of stab at it.
What about the terror of facing an empty Zendo?
Oh.
About the terror of facing a full Zendo.
A full Zendo. You know, the first time I ever gave a talk here, the night before, I had a dream that I came in and there were only 8 people on the Zendo. So I came in and told everybody, so some of you are going to have to leave now. So, yeah.
Was that a good dream or a bad dream? There were only 8 people.
I don't remember. Now either one is fine. Now it's just what it is. Last week there was hardly anybody here. Last week it was so cold. There was hardly anybody here. Either way is okay.